The gods of Egypt. The Egyptians, like most primitive peoples, were polytheists. Their pantheon was very extensive. We must not fall into the serious error of equating primitive with stupid. On the contrary, the state of Egyptian art, architecture, and astronomy indicate a high degree of intellectual attainment. We are forced to the assumption, then, that there must be more to their polytheism than at first meets the eye. Primitive man did not create the gods, as think so many modern students of comparative religion, who are destitute of all sympathy and religious genius. What primitive man really did, perhaps unconsciously, was to apply names and quasi-human faculties to these powers or great forces of nature, which he so accurately observed and which he believed rightly enough to be manifestations or symbols of the divine. All the thoughts and ideas, all the great learning and knowledge of the Egyptians found their pictorial expression in allegory, parable, and painting. The evidence presents itself simply that these many Egyptian gods, all symbolic of the various creative aspects of divinity, are emergence from a ground of being or godhead, which perhaps the average person in earlier days could never have conceived, but which was tacitly assumed by the priestly class. The famous Egyptologist Wallace Budge confirms this idea, stating, "The learned understood the meaning of symbols and paid their adorations through them to the truths of which they were the coverings." This is not dissimilar to the lofty abstract mysticism of Meister Eckhart, which could hardly have been appreciated by, for example, a 13th century German or Italian peasant who angrily might place an image of a saint in a dark cupboard for not having fulfilled the supplicant's wish or prayer. At the head of the Egyptian pantheon soars a god who is one, immortal, uncreated, invisible, and hidden in the inaccessible depths of his essence. So wrote Dr. Marriott Bay in his description of the principal monuments at the Egyptian Museum at Boulak in Cairo. And he continued, "This God is the creator of the heavens and of the earth. He has made everything which exists, and nothing has been made without him. Such is the God who is reserved for the initiated of the sanctuary." Most of the great Egyptian scholars recognized all the gods of all the pantheons as phases or aspects of this great God. Their religion and their gods must not be judged by the standard of the religion and gods of any later civilized nation. We can only know what the Egyptians thought and believed by reading and studying the texts which they wrote. And a final opinion on their beliefs cannot be obtained until all their religious literature has been published. And Wallace Budge went on to say, "The general outline, however, of their religion is clear enough, and it shows us that they possessed a good, practical form of monotheism and a belief in immortality, which were already extremely ancient, even in the days when the pyramids were built. But an abstract, impersonal God is far too vague and nebulous, and altogether unsuited to the layman's needs and comprehensions. It is too far removed from his concrete life here and now. So man needs a more intimate, personal deity to whom he can relate himself in a meaningful way. As he himself grows emotionally and spiritually, he can discard some of the narrow forms that previously meant so much to him. As to which one of these gods a man originally selects, this has as much to do with temperament and basic character as it has with training and conditioning. A soldier or an aggressive personality would find the worship of Horus, who presides over war, more suited to his structure, while a sculptor or a poet would certainly feel nearer to Hathor, who is the patron god of the arts. One person may need a warm, loving mother like Isis. Another may need to feel watched over by a stern, testy senior such as Horus. We may consider the Egyptian gods under two broad categories. First, as personifications of the vast creative forces of the universe, and secondly, since man is the microcosm of the macrocosm, as primitive archetypes within the depths of the unconscious psyche. In fact, Dr. Jung has laid down the proposition that since the primordial archetypes function within the unconscious depths of the human psyche, as the gods of olden times were said to have behaved, we might just as well call them gods, for their function is at all times inviolable, immutable, and consistent. That man was fashioned by the gods in the same manner, or on the same pattern as the cosmos itself, of which he is a part, was implicit in all Egyptian religious belief. Throughout many of the rituals in the Egyptian religious texts, many resemblances are made between the anatomies of various of the gods and of man himself. For example, the individual parts of man were placed under the protection of, or better still, were identified with a god or goddess. His hair was said to be the hair of Nui, the sky goddess. His face that of Aten, the solar disk. The eyes, those of Hathor. His belly and back, those of Sekhet. His phallus, that of Ra, the creative god, and so on. In this way, he could truthfully exclaim, "There is no member of my body which is not a member of the gods." This therefore gave the Egyptian a supreme awareness of the divinity of his body itself. There was no part shameful, no physiological function unclean, for in him and in his every part there was ample evidence of a divine, time-transcending order. Each god in the Egyptian myth had a precise, well-defined function to perform in the cosmos, creative, preservative, or destructive as the case may be. And that function had been accurately ascertained by observation, both secular and religious, carried out over a long period of time, and the qualities and nature of the god were expressed in pictures. That the Egyptians conceived Ra, the sun god, to exist actually in such a conventional art form as that in which they painted him, I must not be construed as believing, nor that they considered the sun at midnight to assume the form of a beetle. What they actually did believe was that the symbol of the scarab expressed in various subtle ways the nature of the sun after the hour of setting at midnight. The cow, likewise, was a symbol of exuberant fertility, the ibis, a god of wisdom and supreme intelligence. The hawk, by reason of its ability to remain poised in the sky, was a perfect symbol of the divine self, which, detached from all things of earth and form, looks down upon them with the eye of equanimity. When Christianity developed later, there was a gradual absorption of some of the contents of the older religions. They were absorbed without too much difficulty. It is recognized by many scholars that some of the characteristics of Isis, for example, were attributed to Mary. Some of those of Osiris, the resurrection god, were similar to those relative to Christ. And many of the other gods were either attributed to the archangels and angels of tradition or embodied in the virtues and characters of the great saints of the early Christian era. It may help to further this idea if we consider individual gods and what they stood for. For example, one of the most important and early gods is named Ptah. His name literally means the opener, or one who opens the way. He is shown on some of the ancient drawings as a potter working at a potter's wheel with a lump of clay, from which he fashions the first men or the earth and the heavens. In his monumental text, The Gods of the Egyptians, Wallace Budge gives innumerable pages describing myths, showing that Ptah was the prime mover, the demiurge, who had with his own hands fashioned and created the worlds. As such, he refers in the microcosm to the secret self hidden in the heart of man. This refers to the self-born, or higher nature of man, without father or mother, because the inner nature of the soul is the matrix for the higher life, born through the exercise of right action, right thinking, and right feeling. Another important god is Thoth, or Tahuti, as he is often called, the divine intelligence, which, at the moment of creation, uttered the word which resulted in the formation of the worlds. Some statues show him with a wand of authority and the Ankh, which is the symbol of eternal life and joy, as well as with the stylus, the instrument for writing, a further evidence of his wisdom and sagacity. The Jungian psychologist might relate this god image to the unconscious archetype of the wise old man who appears at the appropriate time to guide the human soul in the direction of the reconciliation of the two opposites, and so towards spiritual freedom and spiritual wholeness. Isis, who is often shown carrying the child Horus, is believed by Budge and some other historians to serve as the prototype of the Catholic version of Mary and the child Jesus. Many of the ancient litanies written about her worship are not too dissimilar to those found in any Roman Catholic missal. As the compassionate and omnipotent mother of both worlds, she drew to herself a vast throng of devotees and worshippers. She personified the vast reproductive power in nature, conceiving eternally and immaculately. It was her own life that was always used in graciously and successfully restoring those that had need of her. Once again, in psychological terms, she serves as a symbol of profound archetypal concepts which mediate between the depths of the soul and external reality, the inner matrix from which all ideas, feelings, and creativity have their origin. Many of the traditional signs and symbols borne by the gods have equally a very profound meaning. For example, the Ankh, or the Venus symbol, which has become popularized in the current search for meaning, is the symbol of joy and love and eternal life. The lotus, found at the top of many of the wands carried by the gods, is a flower sacred to nature. The lotus has its roots in the material mud from which it springs, passes up through a more tenuous medium, the water, and then flowers wonderfully in the higher open medium, the air. Here are symbolized the physical, psychical, and spiritual worlds, symbolized in a simple way to appeal to the common mind. Its seeds mature in the matrix of the mother plant and are of virgin-born purity before they drop into the water to carry on life. Thus, the lotus flower came to symbolize immortality. According to one authority, the following facts are most significant. Ra, for example, represents fire. In man, consciousness. Shu represents air. In man, mentality or his mind. Seb, or earth, represents in man the material body and all its functions. Osiris, or water, in man, the higher emotional aspirations. According to this same authority, the upright bar of the cross symbolizes the inner nature of man, the inner world of feeling and emotion. To represent the effort man must make to live up to his ideals and thus express his real self, we shall take the crossbar of the cross to represent the will. In the beginning, the crossbar is found at the bottom of the upright bar. But as man progresses, and as a sign of his progress, the crossbar gradually rises or drops according as he exemplifies in his personal daily life the ethical teachings of his religion, be that what it may. Dr. Stewart also wrote that the Egyptians knew of only one way to worship God, and that was to refrain from doing evil. Through the power of independent choice, the individual rises above fate or blind evolutionary law because he possesses innately that power to exercise an independent, self-conscious, and rational volition. He may live his life in accordance with the rules of the great goddess Maat. That is to say, he has the power to do right, governed by his own inner equilibrium and a higher sense of necessity. Thus, the governing causes in the evolution of man are independent will and desire, which stimulate intellectual, emotional creativity, with a new moral purpose as a foundation and ethical satisfaction as an earned increment. And this is the becoming, the transformation, or the higher evolution indicated in the ancient symbolism of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. These are invocations of some of the Egyptian gods. These prayers have their roots in very ancient traditions. What value do these invocations have? Only if they are used frequently and with sincerity and with purpose do they take on meaning. One of the guidelines that has been laid down by those in a position to guide us is to invoke often. The second one is to pray with enthusiasm, with fervor, with energy. Merely to utter these invocations, or any prayer for that matter, in a dull, routine way, is simply to express a mass of words wholly without meaning. These prayers have to be meditated upon so that they come to stimulate the inner core of one's being. At the same time, an even more important matter is that while reciting the invocation, the imagination should be activated to form an image of the appropriate God form enveloping one's actual physical form. If Isis, then one should come to feel that one has about one the traditional female form of the goddess. And in the case of Tahuti, there should be the clear realization that one has an ibis head, the long neck of the bird under consideration, and so forth. If Horus is invoked, the divine falcon or hawk should be perceived in the imagination as clothing one's body. With regular, consistent practice, one may expect to feel the actual presence of the divine energy and to realize psychologically the nature of the God, and in fact to activate those unconscious archetypal forms and characteristics which they are representative of. This is not an intellectual process or activity by any means, but is a heightening of spiritual sensitivity and consciousness so that its awareness is as much of a reality as is the sensing of one's own body or any part thereof. The invocation of Thoth.